All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics, what the fuckleberry fins, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show. This is WTF, the podcast. Got a report for jury duty today. Got to go try to get out of my civic duty. I have to go try to weasel out of what we as citizens should do in the system we are in, or what's left of the system we are in. I'll let you know how that goes. I'm not excited about that. But I got to be honest, though. The last time I went in, I was ready to serve. I'm pretty ready to serve today, but I was honest. You know, the case was a class action against a drug company. I don't even know if it was a class action, but it was against an antidepressant company. I got out of that, but I was honest. It feels a little heavy in court. We'll see what happens. This is positive, though. A new batch of special WTF mugs are in. You can go to briantjones.com starting at 12 noon Eastern and 9 a.m. Pacific today for the mug. While I'll be somewhere in the L.A. Superior Court system trying to figure out a way out, you'll be getting a nice mug. Also, next Monday, my guest is Steve O., who you know from Jackass. His Showtime special, Guilty as Charged, is now available on Vimeo starting today. You can check that out before you hear him on here next week. I guess I'll just, you know, kind of tell you what's going on. I've nothing to complain about. All right? You know, I go out. Maybe I make some dinner. I'll go out, do some comedy. Then I come home, sit on the couch. Maybe watch, some DVR'd Better Call Saul's. And, eat some ice cream, play a little guitar quietly. But some part of my brain is sort of like, man, not again. I'm living it. There's nothing better than sitting alone eating ice cream with the option and the choice to play guitar or watch any show you want. This is what sort of got me weirded out a little bit. I hung out with some friends, Steve Brill and Judd, and it was after comedy, and we were at the Comedy Store, and Judd was hungry, and I had already eaten once with Steve, but we're gonna all go eat again because that's what you do late at night. It's a good thing to go have a full fucking dinner with pasta, mac and cheese, chocolate bread pudding with ice cream, grilled artichoke, meatballs, and fried chicken. It's good to do that 11:30 at night. That's the smart thing to do. But, these guys, they live in nice homes, up with their families. And I talked to my friend Al, who's got a family, nice home. And, I'm doing all right. I don't got to freak out or worry right now. But they cannot, on some level, they cannot understand why I'm living in the same house. I cannot understand, why do I have to get in the game? There's some system in place that is wired into some of our minds that, I've struggled my whole fucking life to get somewhere. And now I'm here to a degree. This is where I'm going to be. Yeah, I'm doing okay. I'm earning an honest dollar, I believe. But why do I have to move up? I'm good. I just figured out what to do with my second bedroom. I only have two bedrooms. I just, in the last 3 months, figured out what to do with that room. It was always clearly supposed to be a record storage room for my weird obsession that will soon become a problem. That's what that room was. Used to be, women that I was living with would move their stuff in and out of that room. Now it's just records. It's a small record store and a giant closet that I built for a woman. So it's just a room with a giant clothes closet filled with clothing that I stole from Wardrobe of Marin. So I'm outfitted. And then there's two huge record shelves in there. And I'm good. I'm set in the house. Do I need another room just to have a room? Well, that's the third room in case somebody wants to sleep here. Rarely happens. I bought a chair. That's something. I bought a nice chair from Crate and Barrel. So why do I need to move up? But there's this weird pressure to it. They were going to go home, which was down the street. And then Steve was like, what do you got to drive an hour now? I'm like, no, I'm going home. This is not the center of the universe here and where we just ate all that food and where there's fancy malls and people who live up in the hills and houses that you see from the street and go, what the fuck? Is that a house? Is that a fucking house? Jesus Christ, who lives there? I'm not going to have one of those houses. I'm fine. And I'm happy to sit in my small living room, eat ice cream, play guitar, watch a DVR by myself. I've arrived. The other thing about, you know, moving up. I don't know what kind of life you live. And, you know, I'm grateful to be, you know, doing okay for once in my life. And for that, not really there. There's no real possibility at this point in time of a woman taking half or all my money. But, you know, it's like I come from the school of, hey, I don't know if I'm ever going to have money again. I'm going to save it. And then, like, you know, I got a small office space for a reasonable price of money. Look, my house needs repairs. You know, I put the driveway in, but I'm going to have to like start putting walls in, or I'm just going to be shaken awake by a collapsing ceiling or something. Starting to look a little broke down up here. But I got more space because I took that office that I was so excited about, only to find that I am being, you know, just drowned in radio frequencies of different kinds and Wi-Fi frequencies from being inside a cell tower. On some level, I'm so glad that, you know, my little stereo setup there in my new office picked up all this stuff, and that it's relentless, this sound, relentless. But that just means that the waves are relentless. And then you've got the FDA or the FCC, whoever decides that, you know, that's okay. That's not too much of that stuff. I don't know. I'm not clear anymore. I'm not exactly clear how much of that frequency I'm not supposed to be inside a cell tower. No one's supposed to be working inside a cell tower, except people who are there to repair the cell tower and then leave. And you know, when you walk down a hallway of someplace you work and there's a door that says, warning, don't go in here. Hide, stop. No machinery making things, connecting with satellites in here. Yeah, I mean, cell phones are bad, but I'm literally, we'll see what happens. AT&T has been pretty good about trying to figure it out, but now I'm starting to worry about, like, how much of that shit can I really take? It's one thing that I can't play a record. That's a pretty luxury problem. But am I going to become some sort of, maybe it's going to end up being a gift, a superpower that I end up having at the end of my tenure, if I am able to even stay in the fucking building. Maybe I'll have some superpower of being able to email and receive phone calls with no phone or computer. Maybe that's going to be my gift. I don't know how I would use that superpower. It'd be more like a parlor trick, I think. Hold on, I think I'm getting a call in my brain. I hope AT&T service is good if I start just picking up in my brain. I mean, we're run on an electrical system, right? Our brain is an electrical system. Like, on some level, whatever I'm picking up through my stereo equipment, that is relentless. Pounding in has got to be pounding into my skull, I would imagine. If a shielded wire that I could cover in copper is still picking up this intrusive frequency, I've got to think that my brain is probably less shielded than that. And I am an electrical system. Oh, fuck. I'll let you know how it goes. I'll let you know if I start picking up static. I think I have been picking up static for a long time. So my guest today, Susan Sarandon, came by for a tight hour. We had a tight hour. I'm not a fan of the hard out. I'm not a fan of the hard out. Her new movie, The Meddler, opens this Friday, April 22nd. I had interviewed her once before with her then partner, the Tim Robbins, and it was for Air America years ago. And, you know, I asked her if she remembered that, and she did not. So we're starting from a fresh start. Clean slate, no recollection of me, though I remembered her. So this is me and Susan Sarandon. Do you remember Air America?
I don't remember anything anymore.
Is that true?
No, but it all kind of has blended. If you give me enough details, things snap in, but...
Really?
Yeah, but there's been a lot of years and people and...
Wild, right?
Yeah.
It's just going away?
No, I mean, I think a lot of it is good that it goes away. You know, that's okay. This is how you forgive.
It's how you forgive
and forget. And,
yeah, things
those details.
Lose their relevance. They lose their ability.
Well, you know what happens is you, like, especially when it comes to suits surrounding a project.
Yeah.
They'll go high and I'll go high. And in my mind, I'm thinking, do I like this person? Was that a good experience? I don't remember exactly. I know them, but which movie was it? Which one was it?
Should I be upset?
I know I didn't have your baby, but what else is this?
I can remember that.
I know that much, but I didn't sleep with you. But did you screw me another way?
Right.
Maybe you did.
Yeah. I'm not.
So I kind of get to a Switzerland. I'm not like air kissing, but I'm not cold.
And you act like you know them.
No, I know them because they come in and you know them. But producers are so, you know, producers on a film are, you can have that title and be the least qualified of anybody on the film. And so there can be six people that you don't even, you know, maybe you actually interfaced with one producer, but they claim to be a producer. So when they come at you, you go, I had dealings, but I don't remember exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are a lot of people on crews that I've worked with a number of times, but I can't differentiate exactly. I remember some. I mean, I remember them, and I know they're the sound, or I know they're props, but I'm thinking, like, which one was that in the 45 years that I've been doing this?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Have you looked at the list of movies you've been in lately?
Well, I had to look because they gave me an Icon Award last night at CineCon.
Uh-huh.
Which was, everyone that goes to CineCon gets an award. It's kind of like Little League, you know, like most improved player.
Right.
And I got the Icon Award, and so they do a little...
The montage?
So I saw every category of CineCon on the screen, the breakout performance, the new, you know, and they do like a... Your career flashes before you, and you get to see it all.
That's what it's going to look like when it flashes before your eyes. Just a montage.
But maybe not of my films.
No.
It'll be of my life, I think, maybe. Yeah.
Is there, like, but is there, there's a big differentiation, I guess, but I imagine your life is marked by the films, isn't it, kind of?
Yeah, but I have a feeling that, you know, it'll be people rather than films.
Sure, you would hope so.
Rushes, yeah. Yeah.
You grew up in New York?
I grew up in Queens for a while, and then we moved to New Jersey.
Jersey.
Because I'm the oldest of nine.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wait, I mean, do you know all your siblings?
Yeah, I think so.
And they're all younger than you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're all still with us?
Yeah.
That's
and today's
crazy.
My mom's 93rd birthday.
Shit, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
93?
93.
That's good.
Yeah.
You're probably gonna...
And she's got tons of great-grandchildren and grandchildren. She can't even keep track.
Do you have grandchildren now?
I do. I have one, and I'm going to have a second one, and it is so much easier than having a child.
Yeah, and the pressure's off a little bit.
Pressure's so off.
And you can just be the great-grandma.
Oh, you're just unclutched. You just don't have any. Do you have kids?
I don't. I don't know how it eluded me.
There's still time.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, be careful.
Well, every guy I talk to my age who does that has the first one in their 50s. About 5 years in, they're like, oh, my God. You know, I don't think about it a lot, but I'm old.
It's just the sleep deprivation. If you're rich and you pick a good baby mama, you know, I suppose you could just... There are a number of people who are just collecting children at this point.
Okay, well, maybe
various women, but you know, it depends on what your idea of participation is.
I
love this idea of having kids. Yeah, you're never there.
Right.
You've got a few women that are having little ewes, and it's a different thing.
I'll get started. I'm not encouraging you.
Put
it on Craigslist. I'm available to have a few little me's with various women if you don't pressure me.
Just don't ask for anything except maintenance of the physical kind.
It'd get messy. What part of New Jersey was that?
Edison. I went to Edison High School. I'm in the Edison High School Hall of Fame, actually.
Just like the Icon Award. You're really building up. Like, you got an Oscar and you're in the Edison
Hall
of Fame.
The one thing I do not have yet that I really am working on and I really want is a rest stop in New Jersey.
What is it?
Named after me.
What, the Susan Sarandon rest stop?
Yeah. I would even split it with Springsteen.
No. Oh.
It doesn't have to be all mine.
Well, is Edison near Asbury Park? What part?
Like, no, but he's not in Asbury Park. No. No.
So what do you
got? It can be anywhere in New Jersey. It doesn't have to be near where I grew up.
Yeah. You want it to have a restaurant and coffee? Or
I want it to be a rest stop. But, right. You know, Bruce Springsteen and I talked about splitting one because if we have to remove somebody.
Uh-huh. Right. But
then we thought maybe if we split it, it
so
would
be so the Springsteen Sarandon rest stop. Maybe you can have one of those ones that's on both sides of the road.
Yeah.
And one side be Springsteen, one side be Sarandon.
Or you could call it Bruce and Sue.
Yeah. Do you talk to Bruce a lot?
Not a lot, no.
Yeah.
When our kids were younger, we did like major memory events that where you're making memories at their place or something.
And you bring them over to swim in the pool and stuff, that kind of stuff?
All even more detailed than that, you know, Halloween trips and things. But
both
I haven't
families?
Seen them in a while, but I love him and I love her.
He seems like a very earnest guy.
Yeah, very thoughtful, works hard.
Yeah.
Talented.
He's all about
the hard
work.
He's going to go somewhere.
Yeah, that kid's got
he's gonna
potential.
Hang in there. Yeah.
But when did you start acting? Are you the only one out of the nine that decided to?
I didn't really decide. I kind of fell into it. At 20, I did Joe, but I was in college in D.C., which was a very...
At George Washington?
No, at Catholic University.
Were you brought up really Catholic?
That was the end of it, was Catholic University, yeah.
And I was there. Do you remember the night?
Well, it was, the more you learn about institutionalized religion, the more you realize its flaws. You realize that as these good ideas became institutionalized, they really lost a lot in translation.
Sure, it was about controlling people.
It was about controlling people and then religion starts to be exclusive and actually gets aggressive towards people that are not in. And I also really always had a problem with the doctrine of original sin.
Yeah.
I'd never bought into that one. That was tough for me.
But how was the childhood? If you were the oldest and you're taking the hit for, you know, you're the first one out. I mean, like, was it strict Catholic upbringing?
Yeah. And I have the most pathetic little picture of me in my Catholic grammar school uniform. I was very sincere. I was praying all the time to have the faith when the communists came over and hung us upside down that I wouldn't deny my faith. And then I went to Edison High School, a public high school with 500 in my class. And the very first day we did the Lord's Prayer, the Protestant version, and I just rolled right over. I just rolled right over.
Sold it out immediately.
Sold out immediately with peer pressure to do that.
Well,
what version.
What was the family doing? What was your dad doing?
Dad started out as a band singer. Went over.
Do you remember that?
No, I wasn't around then.
Oh.
And he went to the war.
Like a big band singer.
Big band singer. Then he went to the war and he had was in charge in Italy of the entertainment there. And there was pictures of him with Marlena Dietrich.
Oh, really?
And introduced actually Burt Lancaster to his wife.
Really?
And then when he came back, he knocked up my mother.
Yeah.
And
before they were married?
No, kidding. Well, they got married before he went away.
Oh, okay.
She never thought he would come back. She said, she asked her girlfriend, should I do it? And the girlfriend said, why not? He'll never come back. She said, okay. So they got married and he did come back.
Uh-huh.
And then he got into the early days of TV and was like a stage manager and director. And then eventually, as he had more and more children and more and more responsibility, he... ended up a vice president of Ogilvy and Mather in advertising.
The advertising, that's a big one.
That's a big one. And so then when Mad Men came out, I really was curious as to, you know, what was going on with Dad during
maybe.
Possibly.
Was he boozy?
I don't know. I mean, certainly not at home, but he commuted. And
well, when you watch that thing, were you like astounded by like, could they really have drank that much all day long?
You know, I don't really drink. I'm more of a stoner.
Yeah.
So this idea of just having a few martinis at night, I don't understand really what makes an alcoholic. I don't know how you define that. But it seemed like that generation drank a lot.
Like three,
as like a social thing and smoked a lot.
Yeah, well, I like the smoking, but like three, I mean, I was a drinker too, but like three martinis at lunch, I'm done.
Yeah.
How does the day go on? How do you go back to work?
I don't know. I mean, now people are on antidepressants, so maybe it's the same, you know.
Maybe that.
Or Coke. I mean, there's a lot of drugs and all kinds of.
Is Coke back? I guess it's back around.
I hear.
Yeah.
I think there's certain professions that never left, like Wall Street.
Sure. Just get jacked
up. I did a
up.
Movie where I played a drug queen for Paul Schrader with Willem Dafoe. So I learned a lot about the drug trade to
Which
Wall
movie?
Street. Light Sleeper.
I have to see that.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I like Schrader is a dark dude.
And this was kind of the continuation of Willem Dafoe's, you know, various people.
Yeah. So wait, so you started, okay, so you go to college, you throw away Catholicism.
Yeah.
And you acted there?
Not really. I had to work my way through. I was living with my grandparents, which meant I didn't really have a college experience. And I was working in the drama department on the switchboard. And
like a real switchboard?
Real switchboard. And cleaning apartments and doing stuff to be able to pay for school. And I met a graduate student. And I was just 17. And he was a graduate student. So he knew everything.
Right.
He knew about black and white film and
poetry. Just blew your mind.
Blew.
That guy.
And was my first sexual experience.
Uh-huh.
So, of course, I was so grateful. I married him.
This was the Sarandon.
This was Sarandon. So I married at 20. Because also I couldn't stay in school if we were living together.
Right.
And I definitely needed to get out of
my
grandparents.
He blew your mind and you were in love.
Yeah.
And
he was kind. He was very...
pretty good actor.
Great actor. He got a nomination for Dog Day Afternoon.
And that was it. That was
Couldn't work again for years after he was so good.
Really?
Everyone thought he was actually transgender. And,
is that true?
Yeah. He had a really hard time after that getting work.
And you like... So Joe, that's a horrendously disturbing movie.
At the time, it was everybody's nightmare. It's not really a very good movie, but the thing that happened, and it was John Avildsen's first movie that he directed, although he wasn't officially in the Directors Guild, so he wasn't listed. He was the DP.
Yeah.
But what happened was that they had hired someone else who I won't mention, but who was to play Joe, and he was crazy, and he peed on the escalator at his wardrobe fitting in Bloomingdale's or something.
How can you not tell me who that is? Are they still alive?
I don't know. I would be surprised if he was. And anyway, they hired Peter Boyle, who had been doing a character at Second City called Joe.
Right.
And he arrived with that character and all of that fabulous improvisational stuff.
But was it a comedic character before it became Joe? Or was
no,
it like just a bigoted...
It was a bigoted... It was just that guy.
Yeah.
And anyway, so he did the movie and it was... You know, I didn't know what I was doing, and I at least had the sense not to act. And I, you know, did my own makeup, hair.
Oh,
it was
really?
The first film that wasn't a porno film that this company had done, Canon. And I had been in New York,
Canon.
And I had been in New York about 5 days. And what happened was that Jane Oliver handled Sylvester Stallone and handled... And she saw Chris in a play, and she asked him to come in and audition, and he brought me with him
to
read the scene.
Were
my
you married
husband.
At the time?
Yeah. We were married. Yeah. He was at the Long Wharf, and I had graduated. And so we went into New York, and I read with him, and she said, well, why don't you come back, too, you know, in the fall? So we went back, and within 5 days, I went up for this, and they'd been looking for someone, and they asked me to do an improv and explained what that was, and that wasn't very difficult, and I did it, and they said, okay. And she said, just come back, do not say anything. and I got the film, and he, you know, Chris also got work. He was in a Broadway show immediately, so I was like, oh, this is cool. And I had a scene where I got to completely trash a little store on 14th Street, and I love that. That was so much fun. And draw all over myself with some unspecified drug I was on. No one even figured that out.
Right.
And anyway, while they were editing it, there was an incident on Wall Street where some construction workers beat up some hippies.
Uh-huh.
And they very cleverly refocused the film and called it Joe instead of just some kind of a generational conflict thing. And so it worked, I think mostly because of him and because the idea, if you were an affluent white family and your daughter ran off to the village with a hippie.
Down the street.
Yeah. You know, that was like she was lost. And they called it the Easy Rider of the next year because it was made on a shoestring. And
it got very, I remember seeing it when I was younger. It's a very disturbing ending.
Yeah.
Like horrendous.
Yeah.
Like, because I remember as a kid registering, you know, Peter Boyle is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in that scene.
But it's her own father that kills her by accident.
Oh.
See, you can't go shooting people. It could be your own daughter.
No, shooting people is generally never good.
Not good.
But you had not done any acting before that? You did television or no television? Like before Joe?
No, I hadn't done anything. Then I got on a soap opera. And I was the girl everything happened to, and that was really taught me a lot.
But did you have any training? Was there any training ever?
No.
Really?
You don't have to be trained to be an actor. Everybody can act.
No, I know, but I mean,
surviving is what's difficult when you're an actor, not acting. And also, it is a profession that kind of rewards mediocrity. So, you know, you can get in a situation and just develop terrible habits and whatever.
But at some point, you learned.
Yeah, on the job. That's the best. That's what I'm saying. It was a great way to learn. But if I'd been on a soap opera for 10 years, I probably would have developed pretty bad habits. But it taught me how to work basically live with cameras. And I was very lucky to have Bill Prince and Augusta Dabney and Stephen Elliott and Susan Sullivan, all these really people that did know what they were doing around me.
Uh-huh.
And then I just kept working because I think I just thought it was hilarious. And
well, you are funny.
And then eventually, no, but I mean, I just thought, well, yeah, why not? You know, and I'll pay back my school debt. And
but you got an agent, obviously.
Well, the gal, Jane Oliver, who was handling me, eventually I did. But they weren't really, looking back, I think they picked up on my kind of not very ambitious vibe, and they weren't particular, and they matched it. And they didn't, because I really was just kind of bouncing around, and there wasn't any plan, and I didn't go up for The Godfather or anything, you know, at that time.
No?
No, I never got a shot at some of those things.
But you worked with, were you in a Billy Wilder film early on?
Yeah, I got that. And
the front page.
And that was the front page, and what happened was I then lost it because they wanted me at that time, I think it was Universal, to sign for some other picture deals, which was customary at that time, but without any script approval.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't seem like a good idea to me, and so I lost it. But then I called them and I said, I just want you to know that it wasn't the money or anything. I just didn't want to sign my life away. But I love you. And then eventually they called me back and I did it. And I got it.
They wanted you.
They wanted me.
And you worked with Jack Lemmon. Did you have scenes with them and everything?
Oh, yeah. Both of them. They were great. And actually, while I was doing that film, I was staying at the Chateau Marmont.
Uh-huh.
And I was going to go into an apartment because I was there for a while.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I'd been to L.A. I mean, I didn't have any idea. You know, to me, it was all just scandalous. It was crazy. And someone came into my room and stole the night before I was moving all my money and my diary
and a
number of other things.
And that hasn't resurfaced?
Maybe they're waiting till I run to office or something. And I went to this and I was distraught, needless to say. And not Jack Lemmon, but Walter Matthau.
Yeah.
Said, oh, I'll help you out. And he took out, because he's a gambler, this huge wad of money and just peeled off, you know, a bunch of it and said, you can pay me back, kid, or not, whatever. And I had never seen anything like that. And that's how I survived until I could pay him back because they'd taken all my money.
And you lived out here then?
Just when I was working. I've never lived out here to live out here. I've only come to California when I've been working or when Tim was working. I would bring the kids out and stay. And so I got to know. I lived in Rustic Canyon a couple of times. I lived in Laurel Canyon. I lived in Santa Monica.
And the 70s were crazy here, right? I mean, was it fun? I mean, it seemed like a much more intimate business. Were you hanging out with people?
It was more intimate. Everything was more intimate. Of course it was. And I knew Timothy Leary. That made it. That was a icebreaker.
Oh, yeah? When you were out here in the mid-70s?
Yeah.
So you did some of that original acid?
Yeah.
How was that?
Just what you'd expect.
Did you learn anything? Did it take you place? Did it change your life?
I think that...
Like meeting Chris Sarandon did?
I think that those kind of drugs, mushrooms and peyote and weed, you know, are more opening drugs than... I never was into cocaine or that kind of stuff. I didn't do a lot of it.
Right.
I don't like chemicals. I don't like things with letters.
I prefer
things that grow, like mushrooms and
ayahuasca.
Weed. I've done ayahuasca.
Recently?
Yeah.
That seems to be a trendy thing right now. I didn't realize it, but there seems to be a real therapy community around the ayahuasca adventure.
Well, I think that's probably better than over-medicating with things that don't help you
absolutely.
Question.
Look, if you can handle it.
I find that's not a recreational drug as far as I'm concerned.
It doesn't sound like it.
But people have been doing a lot of it, but I tend to take it more seriously. And
so, but like when you say take it seriously, like do you have a goal in mind?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
That's part of that.
Yes.
Processing.
The first time I did it, I was offered, I had been helping these shamans from Colombia, to try to preserve their land. This was years and years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come, and I went before Congress with them, and they needed to map their land. And we were trying to assign value to their land, showing what an ethnobiologist that I know was explaining all the different amazing drugs that were there. I mean, plants that were there, and other things to try to establish worth, to map it. And then at one point they said, well, you know, when we come back, do you want to do some ayahuasca? This is all through a translator because I don't speak Spanish.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I didn't really know what it was, really. And so the first time was kind of just a general seeking, but then recently I was looking for some answers and perspective. And so I had that intention when I went in, because it is a bit of a adjustment.
And did you get what you were going in for?
I got what I was going in for, but it wasn't the answer I wanted.
Oh, really?
No, it was not.
Were you okay with it, though?
Yeah. I mean, I was okay with it, but I was looking for something simpler. And it was not.
No, a little more complicated?
Well, I wanted to kind of get a perspective coming out of a relationship where I was just like thinking, yeah, that was ridiculous. Why was I, you know,
right.
And be done with any kind of feelings there. But instead, I kind of got, you should just keep your heart open all the time. You should never close it to anyone, because the whole point is to be open to the divine in every person in the world, and you shouldn't be doling it out intellectually. And it's okay to be hurt, and it's okay for it to be difficult, you know.
Right.
That wasn't what I wanted to hear.
That's true, though. If you're going to go through life open-hearted all the time, it's hard not to get cynical or closed off.
Yeah.
But you're all right?
Yeah, I think I'm all right. I think I'm going to survive.
So when you started, like, when, you know, going back to the movies and going back to your education, you know, as a actor and a creative person, I have to assume that, like, each movie you were learning things. And
still,
you saw,
I mean, that's the whole gift of this profession. Every single thing that you draw to you, and I think you draw projects to you the way you draw people at certain points in your life. Sometimes they present themselves because of some issue or interest or...
Sure.
Something that you're trying to either avoid or examine.
Yeah.
And or sometimes, you know, you go into something and you meet people that you wouldn't have met and that are very significant in your life. So what was the question?
Well, the question, it was not really a question. It was just sort of a conversation, because you work with, you know, George Roy Hill and Louis Malle and all these people. And I don't know, as directors, I mean, you had a relationship with Louis Malle, right?
Right.
So and pretty,
eventually, not before I got the job.
But the first one was Pretty Baby, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a fairly provocative and controversial movie, correct?
Yeah, I think more because he didn't see her as a victim.
Right.
You really don't see her naked. I mean, there.
Who, Brooke?
Brooke. Yeah. I think that it just was this child prostitution. His way of framing it was what disturbed people because she was actually the most together of anybody in that movie.
Right.
And when they were threatening to give it an X rating, they couldn't. I mean, they wanted the word nookie cut, and they, you never even see her nipples. You never see her touched.
Yeah.
So they were hard pressed to figure out exactly what was so disturbing. And I think that's what it was. I think it was, first of all, that she was so beautiful in a kind of mean way, and people lusted and didn't like that feeling.
Sure.
And I think because she was so strong, it wasn't the typical framing of a child victim.
What did you learn from, like, you know, from the relationship, you know, as an artist with Louis Malle, you know, in terms of your craft and what, you know, how you approach things?
Well, I found him interesting as a filmmaker, and Sven Nyquist, who I worked with twice, who was the
cinematographer,
was amazing because his whole way, again, of framing the story was very European.
Yeah.
But Sven's lighting, we were working with this crew that had done kind of B car crash movies, and they didn't have any idea who Sven Nyquist was. And the gaffer the first few days kept putting more and more lights in all the time, and he just kept taking them out. And then in those days, of course, that was film.
Yeah.
So we didn't see the dailies for a while. And when they finally saw the dailies, they started to kind of give him some respect. But they were very out of control. And I think it's the only set I've ever been on where the cooler was just filled with beer.
Right.
And people were doing all kinds of drugs and things. And it was just wild, a group of guys.
Yeah.
And eventually he kind of, and Louis and his... in his egocentric way, you know, of not caring if people are actors or not, just went and got most of the cast during Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
And those gals' work ethic and way of functioning was not really very professional a lot of times. Like, we were not supposed to shave our underarm hair, and they didn't listen to that, and they would, you know, half the time people weren't showing up, and so it was a very crazy set.
Yeah.
And it's a miracle that actually it got done. There was a lot of things that happened on that where cast members didn't come back from the weekend, or
oh my god,
Sven Nyquist's son committed suicide
during that shoot.
Yeah. He had left for a week, and there was very Brooke's mom was incarcerated at one point. And
was there a point where you're like, this production is cursed? You were in New Orleans?
I love New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
I've done a number of films, all of whom have been, which have been crazy, but turned out really well.
Yeah.
Oh, it's got such a strong personality.
Oh, my God.
There's a lot of music down there now, too. A lot of musicians are moving to New Orleans. I love New Orleans.
It's great. It's beautiful. Yeah.
Jeff, who lives at home, was in New Orleans. The Client was in New Orleans. Dead Man Walking, we were in New Orleans half of that.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And did you have any idea that Rocky Horror would become what it became?
No, nobody did. They didn't even release it for years. I mean, that is... I've been in a lot of movies that have had a very strange birthing. But no, I did that because I had a phobia about singing. Tim Curry was a friend of mine because I had girlfriends that were in the stage production in L.A., so I had met him and hung out, and at one point he was in casting. I just went by to say hi, and that was one of those things where they go,
"That's
would
her.
You read it? Could you read it?" And I was like, "Yeah, but I can't really sing." And they were like, "Just read it." And Janet was a part that people had sung very well, but had never found a way to make it funny.
Right.
And I felt like she was this kind of like a satire of every ingenue I had played up to that point. And so I read it, and then they said, "Well, you know, can you sing Happy Birthday? Can you sing Do This? Can you?" And they said, "Oh, you know, you should really do it." Of course, my agents weren't thrilled. And then I thought, "Well, when I get there, you know, they'll get me drunk or give me something that will help me sing because I'm still terrified."
Right.
Because I had always been told that I couldn't sing.
It is scary.
It's a big thing.
It's a scary thing.
Well, it's ridiculous because everybody should be able to just sing.
Right.
Not great,
right.
But you shouldn't feel, that's your ego.
It's a celebration of the spirit. But there's a vulnerability to it, I think, that it, for some reason, for me, when I it was just terrifying because I felt that it was more vulnerable than anything to
sing. Because you didn't grow up in a culture where everybody's just allowing
right.
you to sing.
Okay,
if you go
that's
to
probably true.
Central America or South America or Africa, or certain parts where people
just sing when they wake up, they're singing.
They're singing and they join in. Or if you belong to a church
right.
in the South,
right.
maybe you would
right.
have been singing. But those of us who are repressed in this area are self-conscious. And I thought, okay, I'll do it because then I'll get over this. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Of course, I didn't get over it.
You still have it?
I've had to sing badly in so many films, and I am self-conscious. I had to, Dead Man Walking, when I sing, Sister Helen is a good singer, by the way, but when I had to sing, and then I, you know, some hymn to him when toward the very end
yeah,
of the movie,
yeah, right.
and I went to one of the focus groups in New Jersey, mm-hmm. and when they all complain about your performance,
right.
one of them said, you know, the part I didn't like was when she's got her face all squished between the bars, and she sings so terribly, and she's... And I was like, oh.
That was the only one you heard? Was that the only comment that you registered?
Yeah. Well, I remember it, obviously.
Yeah, yes, you do.
Shame on that person. I remember it.
But your experiences in working with these with Louis again on Atlantic City, which is another very European movie that's a great
know that
American
the,
movie.
The score of it is so French, and it's kind of like a play.
And the space of it, like it was like, yeah. oh my God.
It's strange. I don't know if it holds up completely. John Guare was a playwright, and he rewrote
that
script. And
he's an intense guy.
He was a friend of mine. I introduced him to Louis, and that's how that happened. And he put it in Atlantic City, which it wasn't written to be in Atlantic City.
It was based on a play of his?
No, there was a script originally, and there was Canadian money, and they had to spend it by a certain time.
Right.
And he rewrote it and placed it in Atlantic City, and it did have a voyeur thing happening, but John really made it his own and changed a lot of it.
Because the voyeur thing was like very, it was not menacing. It was sort of enchanting.
No.
It was just him across the way, right?
Yeah, why I'm putting lemon all over myself, I've still never figured out.
To get this fish smell out.
Yeah, but I didn't open them with my breasts. So why was I doing it? I got it from my hands, but, you know, seriously, I don't know what that
was. It was a showcase for your breasts.
Yeah. Well, you don't see them. They're strategic.
Just like right, the windowsill's right there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and you did that crazy late Cassavetes movie. Right?
The Tempest.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was fun. That was really fun.
What island? Were you on an island?
We were in the Mani Peninsula in Greece, which is way like 7 hours below Sparta. And we had taken over this little town. And Quaaludes were being sold over the counter at that time. So in the morning,
the
you
thing?
Would see people just all over littering the beach.
passed
all
out?
Casper just passed out.
Yeah.
Not me, because again, I don't really respond to those kind of drugs.
But right.
We would take over the discotheque at night.
Yeah.
It was called Studio 54, even though it was empty except for Saturday nights. And it was beautiful. It was gorgeous. And all of us were there with Paul Mazursky leading us, and Cassavetes and Victoria Gossman and Jenna Rollins. And we would do talent shows and things because we were all stuck in the middle of nowhere.
Were they fun people?
So fun.
Like he strikes me like with Jenna and him, like that whole crew just seemed like they knew how to have a good time.
Totally. They you know, they were so interesting and so great. And I actually tried to get fired from that movie.
Why?
Well, we were doing rehearsal and, you know, he wanted her to be in high heels, and my idea of what she was more modern and kind of adventurous, and I felt that she really loved the guy, and he didn't feel that I loved John, and so I cut off all my hair thinking that would get me fired, and that didn't work, and then I just said I'm going to quit, because I thought I can't go be with this guy on an island, you know.
Yeah.
We're just so don't.
You and John?
No, me and Mazursky.
Oh, right.
So I went to John and I said, he was staying at the Wyndham Hotel, and I said, you know, I'm sorry, I just came to tell you that I really have to, I can't do this anymore. We're just not in the same place, and it's just not going to work. You know, he doesn't think I love you, and I just don't understand what to play. And he said, if you leave me, I will break your legs. Which was not at all what I expected him to say. He said, listen, you don't have to listen to him. You know, we'll just, you can love me. You just love me. Don't listen to him. We'll just do it. Come on, you have to come. You know, you can't leave me now. You have to come. Just do it. You'll be fine. It'll be fine. We'll have fun.
Did you?
Yeah, he was right. We just didn't listen. I stormed off the set once. I did storm off the set because there was some issue because my underpants, I was just wearing t-shirts and underpants.
Yeah.
I think there were a number of movies with no bras. I don't know. That was like the thing at that time. But I had underpants on and it became all about, he said, they're too on the nose.
Mazursky said that?
Yeah. And I was so pissed off. I took them off and like threw them. And as I walked off bare assed, I thought, what are you doing? This is so stupid. This is so stupid. Anyway, we had a good time. He would give Molly Ringwald and I, we in our boredom worked up that little singing number we would do in the pool at the hotel. We would do water ballets to Why Do Fools Fall in Love? And so he put it in the movie, the song. But anytime he wanted us to sing, we would charge him money. And that's how we got cash. We'd be out at a restaurant, Raul would sing. And and then he'd ask us to do something. And we would say, well, you have to pay us.
And that's how you got cash?
Cash.
And then you've worked with both Scott brothers.
I know. There aren't too many people who have done that.
And like Tony Furso?
Tony Furso was his first film, The Hunger.
It's a crazy movie,
It's a crazy movie. And he was so wonderful and... And, you know, that was a strange experience because in the middle of it, somebody had stolen a lot of money or something from the production. And suddenly they were cutting things out and changing the ending. And Catherine and I, you know, tried to stick up for him and protect him.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. He was great. David was great. That's when I got to know David.
Yeah. Was that amazing?
Yeah.
Did you stay in touch with them? It's so
sad. We were together for like 2 or 3 years. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. So you know, you were on the inside there.
I was on the inside.
And was, did you stay in touch? You know, were you?
Yeah, we stayed in touch. I mean, like, I so admire Iman and that part of his life.
Yeah.
We did stay in touch. We didn't hang out a lot, but you know, he was in New York and our paths crossed, and I would see her a lot too, and I really respected him, and I thank God reconnected with him
before he passed.
Yes. And I was so happy. That was a real gift.
It's very interesting to me about him is that like it seemed like at the core of it he was a very sort of, you know, classy person,
like, very private, very had a lot of integrity, very traditional in some ways, especially where his kid was concerned and his, you know.
His kid made a great movie. The Moon movie.
Yes, absolutely.
This is a really good movie.
I love that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like, you know, behind all of the theater was a fairly private and...
Well, I think he evolved. I didn't know him in the early days in Berlin.
Sure,
and the,
right.
You know, I didn't know him then. But I think like all the very interesting people... artists of different kinds that the temptation is that when you find something that works, you keep on doing that and preserve that. And I think that
milk it.
The really interest, and you're encouraged to do that.
Yeah,
whether
of course,
it's
by the record companies
that,
or, yeah.
Well, and as an actor, they don't, you know, they, if you're successful as a boot, they don't want you to be a sandal next, you know, they want to buy what they know works.
Yeah.
And I think that's true in that odd, combination of art and commerce, you know, that's where you get in trouble. And people like Bowie and, you know, there are other artists too, that I really admire that they keep looking and have their eye, you know, to the culture and their finger on the pulse and
they take chances.
Work with different people and they take chances. And he was doing that right up to the end. When I saw him the very end, he said, you know, what's amazing is this has been such a productive year. It's just been such a productive year because he had health issues and there was a period where he wasn't writing that much. And And then he just exploded with all of this and the play that Lazarus that was going on too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and he seemed to sort of be very aware of the time running out and what to do with it.
Aren't we all at a certain point?
I think. I don't know how we'd be as productive as him necessarily.
That's a whole other thing. And plus, and then he also had this amazing, younger child. And as I said, Iman, I think, matched him in terms of someone who had this incredible beauty and was so strong and also kind of alien-like from another culture. And yeah. It was a really beautiful union.
That's nice. So you did, Riches of Eastwick was fun, I'm sure, right?
No, Riches of Eastwick, we had a really hard time because George Miller really hadn't worked with the studio and the script kept changing and nobody knew what they were doing and it was double it went from 3 months to 6 months and, for me it was very hard because everybody else lived in L.A. and when we got to L.A., and it started off, I show up for work and they give me a different part. So I've prepared for the part that has all the scenes with him.
Yeah.
And for some reason, my lame agents at the time couldn't do anything about it. And I ended up doing a part where I now had to learn to play the cello in like 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. And played instrument.
Oh, my God.
And I had an 18-month-old baby that I was single mom and I couldn't. And they said, well, you can't drop out. If you drop out, we'll put a cease and desist on anyone that tries to hire you. And, you just better find a way to do
bullied
this.
You into it.
So, or don't work for a while.
Yeah.
And so I stayed and sat there and listened to Cher complain about my part. But all of us, everybody got along and that whole part of it was great, but it was very difficult. And I didn't even have, she gave me wardrobe from her show and a wig from her show. They didn't even provide me. I don't know what was going on, but it was not a very easy shoot.
Then you do Bull Durham and you meet Tim.
Right.
And Kevin and Ron. Right. And you get involved with Tim then?
Yeah. Not immediately, but afterwards. Yeah. And then I had two boys with him. So that was
I saw one of them the other night. Tall guy.
Yes, Jack Henry. Yeah. He's a director now and a writer and filmmaker. And
I think my assistant auditioned for him for something.
Oh.
But that relationship, whatever happened, ultimately, it seemed pretty productive and
very
creative.
Very productive. I think that's a sign of a good relationship too, is when a lot of good stuff come out of it.
Well, you're so sharp and I imagine it was compelling to work with the person you're with like that.
For me, the hottest thing you could possibly do is to create something. It doesn't have to be film, but anything, to actually have something outside of yourself besides your child that you work on. I think if you can sustain it, I think that's just keeps a relationship alive and is so much fun.
And you liked him as an actor?
Yeah, it takes a really smart guy to play that kind of an asshole. He specializes in assholes. And he brought to that project, and it was funny because the studio really wasn't high on either of us. And I think it was such a great give and take, the three of us, in terms of the music of the characters and the balance of the characters. And Kevin is so generous. He was the one that stood up for us. He was the one that made it possible. He was so hot at that time, both as a person, but also career-wise.
Yeah.
And he, because it was a first-time director, there was a lot that, because of Kevin, happened. And as I said, they really weren't interested in hiring me or Tim. I had to audition, and all the women that they wanted wouldn't audition. And Ron, he really wanted to hear it. So I was living in Italy, and I flew myself over at great expense, left my child behind. So I turned right around and went back as quickly as I could, came in, did the audition, got on a plane, and went back. But the audition was the entire film, reading the entire film.
Oh my God.
And we didn't even have a phone in our house in Churchill, which is where I was living. And a few days later, I got the call to come back.
Great.
Yeah.
And Thelma and Louise, that's another movie that changed lives.
Yeah.
This is one of the great, feminist movies before there was really that in the mainstream.
But we didn't, when we did it, Ridley Scott was not known as a feminist.
No, I know, about the dynamic.
Well, we thought it was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And I think the dynamic, we provided a lot and it was a great idea and everything. But I think also Ridley put us in this heroic vista, he put us in, it could have been a little tiny movie,
right?
But his eye, the joke when we were doing it was that, because we just shot so many sunrises and sunsets and travel shots, and we were like, the whole movie is going to be a voiceover. You're never going to see us at all. You're just going to see all of this amazing stuff. And the guys on the crew just adore him, and they were all bare-chested with their t-shirts around their heads and going off into the sunrise, the sunset, catching this, catching that. And Gina and I would just go back and go, I don't know. You think we're going to be in this movie? You think at the end of the day we're going to survive the cut? I don't know.
That character was so you were so good.
Thank you. Now we're having a renaissance. We keep seeing each other because the anniversary's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's taking pictures and asking us to do things together. So it was great. We've been able to see each other more.
How's she doing?
She's great. She's great. She just did a pilot and, she's got kids. She came the other day to the after party.
At the theater?
At the theater.
I ran out.
Yeah, she came just to say
hi.
That's
sweet.
Yeah, she's a great gal.
And with Dead Man Walking, had you been nominated before?
Oh, yeah. Four times.
Yeah. For Atlantic City?
Atlantic City, The Client.
That's a good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
It's a very good movie. He was great, that guy. Brad Renfro. Yeah,
sad.
So sad.
Sad fucking story, man.
I know. I see Joel often in New York, and we always...
Yeah.
That was so sad.
But with Dead Man Walking, that movie was... did you feel that when you and Tim were working on that you're both politically active, so the drive of that to create a sympathetic character out of that character?
I met Sister Helen.
Yeah.
She gave me the book based on people that she knew that were political that gave me a good recommendation. She had no idea who I was as an actor. She knew I was in Thelma and Louise, and she was worried I was the other one, and I came in and met her when... I was there for The Client, actually, in New Orleans, and I had dinner with her. And over a handshake, she gave me the book. But it took me over a year to convince him to do it. It took me having a little meltdown, saying, all right, then I'm going to give it to somebody else. He had another film he wanted to do that he was writing. He really wasn't into it. And so after a while, I just said, look, I'm going to go to somebody else with this if you don't want to do it.
Playing hardball with
you. And he said, well, I felt that... For me, it was a love story. Mm-hmm. All the movies I do are love stories. And this was a question of unconditional love. That's what religious people do. They love you unconditionally like Jesus did. They don't ask if you're guilty. They don't, We, except for having children, don't really love that way. And maybe it's a good thing we don't.
Yeah.
So that's what I thought about it. I thought this is this love story that is compelling, a story of redemption, but has this other framing, which is the question of the death penalty, but it's a very personal story, and that's why I thought it would work. So finally, he said he would read the book. And the people that had given him money for Bob Roberts, which was a great film, which should be released again now, were really interested in Dead Man Walking more than the other one, which he didn't like. And finally, it kind of got in his imagination, and he did a brilliant job of combining the two people that are in the book and changing it from electrocution to the most humane way of killing someone.
The lethal injection.
Lethal injection. And we never thought anybody would really, it was a low, but a little bit less than a medium. It wasn't low budget, but it was definitely.
How'd you get Sean involved?
He just asked him, and there were problems with Sean's availability, and I said, there's just so few people that will be scary enough and sympathetic enough. We should wait for him.
Yeah.
And we did, and he knew a good role when he
Yeah.
Read it.
You guys were great. It
Thank
was amazing.
You. Thank and you. And I loved working with him.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Great actor?
Yeah. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of people who have bad reputations on mm-hmm. films, and I've never had those problems.
It was an astounding movie. Now, I watched The Meddler.
Uh-huh.
And this is an independent film that, like, how did you come to this project? Did you just love it? Or?
They came to me, yeah. And I met with Loreen, the writer, director, who was writing it about her mother and her family, and very, very...
Very personal.
Very personal. And I liked her, and I always ask somebody if I'm going to do a film, why do you want to do this film? And you'd be surprised how many directors don't have an answer.
Yeah.
She had an answer, and she was very passionate about it, which was seductive. And I knew it was a good part, but we didn't, wasn't the script needed another pass. But anyway, then she sent me a little sizzle reel of her actual mom doing the actual beginning of the film, the whole beginning of the film, driving the car in bed, waking up, going to the group. And I just was, wow, she's great. What a great character.
Right.
She's so open and so funny and so inappropriate constantly. And I thought, this is going to be really fun if we can find, a good cast. And then my agent really hung in there and tried to help with financing and pushed it along. And eventually JK said he would do it. And then he got the Academy Award. And I was really worried that he wasn't going to do it. But then he said, yes, he was still going to do it. And he's in, you've never seen him that way.
Who are we talking about?
JK Simmons, the zipper.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
He's great, but I mean, he's always
sweet.
Great, but
he
you never
sweet.
See him like that.
So sweet.
And kind of sexy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Rose said she would do it, which was...
I've interviewed her. She's
amazing.
Nice.
Oh, she's great. And I knew her. She's a friend. And so... And then the gift was just this army of stand-up comedians and great...
Gerard.
Funny people, Gerard, all those gals. So I was really surrounded, even in the tiny parts, by people that you could improv with and we were working, needless to say, very fast.
Yeah.
Because it was a low budget film and no, trailers or
anything. Yeah, yeah. And you got to do a New York accent.
Kind of New Jersey, Long Island. Yeah. That was fun.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you prepare for how do you put together you got the material on the mother, but in general, what's your preparation process for a role? How deep do you go? What do you start with?
Well, I don't forget my own name.
Yeah,
that I do not go that deeply, but it depends. I mean, the it's a trade off when you're playing a living person because you have a wealth of specifics,
which
is the job of an actor is to make it as specific as possible so it becomes universal. But then you have this weight of hoping that you're going to not patronize the audience or the character, not wink at the audience, especially if it's a comedy. And the approach to this one was to be as rooted in reality as possible. You're always trying to determine what the tone is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find out by asking, what would be your ideal cast? Even if you can't get them, you get some sense of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And so I listened. I had Tim Monick, who's a great dialect coach, and I've worked with many, we couldn't afford to have him on the set, but he went through the script, and I had on my phone, scene by scene, a lot of the words, the critical words, and I was wearing her clothing. It wasn't hard to figure it out. And then I think you just... open yourself up and fly with it, just jump in and kind of let it take you. And I think that, I certainly know what it's like to be lonely or to miss someone. I, thank God, haven't lost a spouse, but that I've been with for that long. But you still, I've had relationships end, and I'm definitely not comfortable dating. I'm still trying to figure that out, and it's been crazy. And so it's not, I think if it's there, you kind of just surrender to it at the end of the day. And so it went from being her mother to being me to being something else that just happens. And
that's
what always is the surprise. And it's the thing that's addictive about this process is that, first of all, you never feel you get it completely right. You know, you're either not brave enough or specific enough, or you were on to something, but you didn't really commit to it. And so you see it and you go, ah, maybe next time I'll get that. And also, when you're working with people and things happen that are surprising. And I found myself surprised a number of times. So that was great.
A lot really of improving?
Not a lot. Yeah. There are lines that I did and business I did that are in that were improv'd, you know, and it was great because like one of the scenes is a very quiet little talking scene with JK and he says, well, you know what they say about chickens or eggs or something. Yeah. And I go, no, I don't. And that wasn't the answer I was supposed to give him. And he just goes, oh, you don't, you know, and it went into something else. And that's in the movie.
Yeah.
And he could go with it. And that's the joy of working with people that are flexible and confident.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're hiring local actors that haven't acted, you know, and in movies, sometimes you have to hire people that are there that have really not done anything. And then you get in a situation and something changes. They just
freak out.
Stop.
Yeah.
They just stop.
This is not what's on the paper.
Was she going to be saying that? I didn't know that. And I just loved all those gals,
you know,
that were there. And Gerard was very special. I've seen him since.
I see him a lot at the Comedy Store. I do stand-up, and he's great.
Well, I had never gone on, like, a stand-up tour where you're going to one club, and then you can see that person in the next club
change depending on
the audience and how the timing changes, and that was really fun.
Yeah, he's good. He's very... wide open and sweet.
So sweet. Yeah. And he's got quite a schedule with that TV show now.
Yeah. They picked it up.
Writing,
it's going well.
Everything. Yeah.
Well, look, you know, you look great.
Thanks.
You sound good.
Thanks.
I'm happy to see you.
Well, I'm glad I made this pilgrimage.
Do you feel okay about everything?
Yeah, I feel good about everything.
Yeah?
Yeah. Did I give away any secrets I should
No, I don't think so. I mean...
No, I don't think so.
We talked about... It was good. And we didn't get, you know, mired down in politics. And, you know, we talked about stuff.
I'll save that for the rest of the day.
Oh, yeah? Is that what you're going to do?
No, well, it comes up because there aren't that many women that aren't supporting Hillary that are in this business. And so when they find one that they can...
Let her talk.
And I think I'm doing Bill Maher tonight, actually.
Are you?
Yeah.
Are you going to, like, get into it deep?
I have no idea what I'm going to do. I have no idea what's going on.
You love Bernie?
I love Bernie.
Yeah.
Bernie's restored my faith in humanity and the United States of America.
It's rare that you see somebody real, like, who's righteous and means it.
Well, he's earned it. He's been the same guy for years and years and
years.
Since
the 60s.
Standing for the same things and has not... accepted a dime from everybody. So it's kind of like in sports when everyone's on steroids and then you meet an athlete that's not and you go, oh, wow, that can happen? How fabulous.
Naturally.
And also as somebody who really got battered in the lead up to the war, when he stood, I still even now when I talk about it, it gets me emotional, but when he stood up and was so clear and so brave at that time because that was a hard thing to do when he voted against the war. And he, every single, if you Google that speech and you see what he said, then you could go, oh my God. You know, he doesn't make a false move because it's so authentic. And I think people respond to that. And it's been really special to go around the United States and see so many people who felt disenfranchised or, you know, farmers, people who care about the environment, and finding the only candidate that's against fracking or, you know, GMOs, and to be able to see them want to believe again, because you make yourself so vulnerable when you're not cynical about the process.
And also you're vulnerable if shit has not gone your way and you don't get angry and you still maintain some hope.
Yeah, hope is all we got, though. So, I know. I'm encouraging hope.
All right, well, good. Thank you for stopping by here.
Thank you for having me. Now I know where you are. I'll come back again.
Please, anytime.
Can we have a barbecue? I see you have a barbecue.
Sure, there's a little barbecue out there. Just you don't even have to call. Just come over.
Just find a driver that can find it.
Just knock on the door.
Susan's
here. I guess we're cooking.
You never leave?
Sometimes I do, but you can wait.
But I should bring my own groceries if we're going to have a barbecue?
All right, well, then get in touch with me,
okay.
and I'll prepare.
All right.
All right, honored that heart out. Got her in and out. Boom, boom, onward she went to do some photos with the foreign press. Oh, okay. jury duty. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. I believe you can get a link to my upcoming shows, my workshop shows, my riffage shows at the Tripany House at the Steve Allen Theater here in Los Angeles. I believe those start May 10th and run through June on Tuesdays. Go get those tickets for cheap. Benefit the theater, benefit me. Got to figure some shit out. Got to put together the new stuff. Go check out our new website, WTFpod.com. I believe you can still email, but no comment section. Oh, those words are so great. No comment section. How great does it feel to say that? I wish that was everywhere. That should be some sort of unspoken rule. No more comment sections. Yeah, that's a... Just a Stratocaster straight into an amplifier. And I, you know, I'm doing this because this is what I do at the end now. Boomer lives.